And I want to go back to this matter of, because it is very interesting to me, when I was reading about the problems you were having, because it's that everyone wanted the violin concerto to be performed, the venue had been chosen, everyone was very excited. And then, as you say, there was this problem because you had wanted to have your son do it, but my feeling was perhaps, and this is the commercial side of it all, I wondered if they thought, simply as a commercial device, that their thinking was, if we can find someone with a quote-unquote name or who is internationally renowned or whatever to do this. But then the odd part of it from the perspective of the composer is that, as you said, and I'd love to talk to your son about this, there is the reality of the bond between the father and son and the nature of the performance. And I thought, this is really complicated. And I was wondering if, as you sort of discuss with them the nature of this, if they came finally to understand what your insistence was about.
No. My friend Jim Underkoffler, who had commissioned when he was the CEO at, rather when he was director of, at Eastman of the Eastman School of Music, and he had commissioned a forceful orchestra, came to the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I thought when I finished the work that since Jim, whom I had met only very briefly, had thought enough of my music to commission for us an orchestra, that now that he was the CEO of the Philadelphia Orchestra, that he would be interested in having my son Gregory premiere the work with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And I was quite blunt about the fact that I've been trying for years to get the Philadelphia Orchestra to play something other than my lyric for strings on their subscription series, and had no success in dealing with Jim Underkoffler's predecessor, Kluger, who gave me the usual kind of runaround. And Jim, being not only the gentleman that he is, immediately said, well, send me the score. And I said, well, this is just a skeleton version. And this is a piano. It's not a reduction, but I work creating a piano score. This is just a piano score, which will tell you very little because it's just like a kind of skeleton in which I build when I do the orchestration. So I sent it to him, and he said he would pursue the idea, which was extraordinary because he had just become the CEO. There were problems, enormous problems, which he had to face and which literally undermined him to the point where he resigned because the resistance to what he wanted to do was so great that it wasn't something he wanted to deal with. So for him to accept the possibility of presenting the work was in itself extraordinary. So he had, obviously, and I to persuade other persons that this was a work that should be done, and moreover, that it should be done by my son. And when he was able to make a case for this, someone in the orchestra had been in communication with Carnegie Hall, because the orchestra, which plays in Carnegie about three times a year, was going to be playing in Carnegie during the festival that Jesse Norman had created, and it seemed to be an exceptional connection to have the orchestra play this series called Honor, and to have Gregory perform the work. And I thought everything had been settled until I received this very extraordinary, touching, moving note from Jim, in which he said, I'm having problems. What can I do?
Incredible. It's an extraordinary
what
thing.
What can I do? And I was very forthright. And I said, well, if Dutoit is willing to do something else, at the time of the program in Carnegie, and to do the violin concerto later, Jim arranged, he talked with Dutoit. Dutoit said he wanted to do Lilacs, which was done in March of 2009, and because Dutoit was not available to do the violin concerto, then Yuri was contacted and said that he would do it in the following December. But there has not been anything made of this connection between father and son. To have a major work done in which there's this familial connection is just relatively unprecedented. Someone tried to relate connection between Mozart and his father. I couldn't find there's anything or any real significance. But to have something done in a series that was primarily going to be devoted to accomplishments by black artists in music, and yet Jesse Norman was the person, I was told, who vetoed the idea. And she may have been persuaded by somebody in Carnegie Hall because they wanted to bring in somebody from one of the major managements. And I was told the violinist whom they were considering, who was trying to extend her career by doing more contemporary music.
Ah, I see. It's an amazing thing. It was one of the sections reading about it that one of the most puzzling aspects. Very strange.
Yes.
Apropos this dealing with the orchestras, I think one of the oddest things about your work is the fact that as you read, and if you hadn't written it, we wouldn't know. I had no idea the number of major orchestral performances and premieres your works had undergone. As I went through, of course, Boston, there's New York, there's Cleveland, there's Minneapolis, there's the National. There's this extraordinary series of works. Were any of these, even though we don't have them commercially, do you know if these things were at least recorded internally? Do they exist in archives? Surely there's an archive recording of Lilacs. There must be.
Yes, there was. As a matter of fact, in order to make the submission, the Pulitzer Prize Committee, I had to submit, at the time it was a cassette of Lilacs, and I was very fortunate in being able to get one from the recording engineer in time to make the submission. And when I thought it was important to have the work recorded, and I tried to get information from the Boston Symphony about their willingness to allow me to use it. There were four performances. I could work out some type of compilation from the four performances of the best of each, and I wanted to know what the cost would be, and I was told it would be $17,000, which would not include what I would have to pay to Ozawa and to the soloist Ray Robinson, and other incidentals, just to get something that was not a finished product, in which the quality was compromised as a cadet. And of course, it was not feasible to do this. The getting permission to use something that has been recorded by the orchestras would involve dealing with the unions. The only the one performance that I've had of my mass that I fortunately have, which, despite the fact that at the very last section in the orchestra, the concerto gets lost. One of the recorded performances that I would love to be able to put on a CD, but I would not be able to afford, even if the orchestra agreed to allow this to be transferred.
It's an extraordinary set of situations. I know that as I was reading through this, as you say, you keep coming up against the simple reality, the mechanical reality of engravings and getting things printed and getting things recorded. It's an amazing superstructure that stands between the public being able to hear the work, your being able to get it done the way you want, and everybody getting paid. I do know that I was looking up recent performances of your work, and I know that Marion Alsop, I think, recently, within the last couple of months, I think did the Foils. I think that's right.
Yeah, that's correct. It was last August to see it at the Cabrillo Festival.
And I was thinking, I think that we've reached the point with certain of your works that you've gotten to that stage that John Carigliano dreams about and rails about. He says that it's one thing to get something premiered, and then you dream of a repetition, of trying to see that it's done in other places. But I think that there are certain of your works that, in fact, have reached that point. And this is really, really rare, I think, for modern works. And is this something that you've begun to recognize about certain pieces of your work?
Quite to the contrary. Quite to the contrary. Just this morning, I was putting together some articles and reviews to send off to orchestras. Corigliano, of course, is very fortunate, I think, when he had his first symphony performed. He had something like 28 performances in 1 year. He's gotten two recordings of the work. I'm not in the same boat. I had, and Gregory, my son, knows Alsop rather superficially, but of course he was in Colorado, and of course he teaches in Colorado, and I had been trying to get her to do the violin concerto. I sent her recording. I was fortunate because I had the recording done before the premiere. I sent her the score, and she sent a wonderful email saying, "Wow, this is fantastic playing. It's a wonderful work." She decides at the Frio Festival to program Foils, which is fine. And at that time, I emailed her and said that I hope that she would consider, and this is not the first time that I mentioned that the violin concerto, that she would do it in Baltimore or some other place. Not a word. No response, whatever. And this is what continues to be. I have been in contact with the New York Philharmonic, sent them scores, sent them CDs, sent them articles, other orchestras like the Cleveland Orchestra, you know, today, the Nashville Symphony, the Buffalo Symphony. It's like starting all over again. And there's just no continuity. And this, of course, is exactly what happened to my career as a pianist. I mean, I would have great success in New York, couldn't get with the management. Great success in Europe, and then before I got sick, I still wasn't getting concerts. It's a replication of the same thing.
Yes, I mentioned this to you in an email that it is one of the truly extraordinary moments in the reminiscences that you have in the aftermath of this extraordinary academic success you've had in school, your work with Zirkin, your work with Boulanger, your European tour as a pianist, and then when it comes to the reality of how to make a career as a black pianist in the world or in America, it's as if everyone just throws up their hands and says, we don't know. And as you say, to hear the works of black composers, if it were not for these special series, we would have no idea that these works existed. But more importantly, and this is something that Paul Freeman really brings out, it is the quality of the work. I mean,
yes,
they're really just extraordinary pieces. And this was a thing about particularly the Columbia series that just stunned me. I was completely unprepared. And as I say, by the time I got to the disc that had your trombone concerto and markings, I just threw up my hands and thought, this is unbelievable. If there's work like this that exists and that no one knows it exists, it's insane. And
that's exactly the way Robert Shaw felt. And the impact that the series had initially was identical to your reaction now. And then there has been quite a significant improvement in opportunities, and I say this in my book without a doubt. But at the same time, being able to build on the success of one performance is still almost impossible. But it's also part of the general musical culture where, even with the orchestras, they're always thinking in terms of, well, let's commission something, and we want something new. And it's as if they are incapable or unwilling to evaluate things that have merit that should be repeated. They would much prefer to take a chance on doing something that would turn out to be an absolute flop than of doing something that has some known quality and that should be heard more than once.
It's a strange and extraordinary situation. I'd like to two things. One, I want to just have you briefly, just in case, for insurance for my sake, if the computer completely subverted me, I want you to have a few remarks about the origin of the lyric for strings, and then to talk just a minute or two and about the trombone concerto, and then we're going to do a summation. What I'd like to say to begin, I think that watching the lyric on YouTube the other day and finding that interesting production with the eight young people playing, this is a piece that really seems to move people. And its origin, I know, was in an extraordinary moment in your life. And just tell our public a bit about the origins and its evolution.
When I had played my debut recital in New York, and I played with the Philadelphia Orchestra, I decided that I wanted to spend time developing my piano repertoire, but I also wanted to have another year of study with Scalero, my teacher at Curtis, who primarily to write a string quartet. And when I finished the first movement, I had to decide what type of second movement I wanted to write. And in conversation with Scalero in one of my lessons, he had spoken about Barber's Adagio for strings, and according to him, I don't know if it's true, that Barber had been influenced by the second movement of the Opus 135 string quartet of Beethoven. I knew that quartet, always been extraordinarily fond of it, and I looked at it, and there were some things that immediately struck me, that there's virtually no connection that I could see between the shape, the structure of the Barber work and the Beethoven. First of all, the Beethoven second movement, slow movement, is sectional, and Barber's Adagio is in a very clear way. In Gomez, Adagio is not. But at the same time, I wanted to do something different, and I decided that I wanted to create something that was more contrapuntal, and the lyric for strings is also different than either two works, in that it fluctuates between modality and tonality in the shape of the imitation in the linear construction. The primary linear construct of the work, and that offsetting this linearity, these brief moments in which there's a cadential formula that it's repeated after the first time twice. In fact, it concludes the lyric, which is something that is not to be found either in the Beethoven or in the Barber. And after I had finished the work, I learned from a telephone call from my father that my grandmother had passed. And then I decided that it would be a fitting memorial to dedicate this one movement to her. My grandmother was extraordinary in the sense that few people knew her, even persons who would come to the house. She would stay in another room while they would be in the parlor talking with my mother. She seldom went outside. So shy, so self-effacing, and the extraordinary relationship that she had with my mother. She supported my mother in the most remarkable way by just being there. My mother was a real conversationalist. She was talking all the time, and my grandmother would always be there to listen to her. And she represented a pillar in the family that would be missed, and that I realized with her passing that my family was falling apart and that she could never be quite the same.
Yes. Well, it's a deeply affecting piece. And so much of what you say you feel, I feel, comes across, and I think it's very, the reason that people feel, without knowing any of this, feel about it the way they do. By contrast, the extremely playful and lyrical trombone concerto that's had at least two extraordinary commercial recordings that I know, one on Sony and then the fabulous Beast recording with Lindbergh. Did you think, when you finished this piece, that you had a piece that brass players would really take to?
No, it never occurred to me to think beyond that initial performance. I had a lot to think about because the first piece of music that I had completed for orchestra, and having to sit through the rehearsals and realizing the difficulties that Howard Hanton had in conducting the meters, that I was just hopeful that the performance would go well. Unfortunately, for the Poindexter, the trombonist for whom I wrote the work, was extremely nervous, and he just flubbed passages after passages. But it was astonishing that when he finished, that the hall exploded, and the realization that this concerto was a huge success despite the poor playing was a kind of revelation to me that I had written a work for an instrument that I never heard played as a solo instrument, that I never had heard any of my orchestration before. But I never thought beyond that. I was primarily concerned, frankly, with what I was going to do the following year. I applied for Fulbright to study piano, and nobody had suggested to me that I should send this music around to all the trombones, but there was also the more or less discouraging statement made by Emory Remington, the trombone teacher at Eastman, that only two persons who could play the piece because of its difficulty. So there was no reason for me to think of what would be in the future as far as performances would go with the work.
Given the great arc of your work and your life, you came to classical music in the time of profound segregation in this country, almost no knowledge at all of most of the black classical music that had been or would be written. You've lived to see, under whatever conditions, extraordinary orchestras. I was reading how there was a performance of orchestral work of yours, I think a set of variations for orchestra, done by the Philharmonia in London. The Pulitzer for the Lilacs, the piano concerto that is astonishing and a wonderful performance by Henderos, and your great luck with the people that you've met, being pushed by the Zimbalist family, and the wonderful connection you've had over the years with the Moyer family. Looking back on all these things now, how do you feel about your career at this point, and what do you think of the state of modern music in general and the black composer in particular?
It's been gratifying to have these connections pop up, because literally I could not have anticipated that Serkin would tell me that Mr. Zimbalist had something that he wanted to do for me. This is the way he put it. I had no idea that it would read that she wanted to present me in a town hall recital. I had no idea when the owner of Death Store Records suggested that I see Paul Kapp after I talked to him about getting my music, the difficulties of getting my music published, and to meet Paul Kapp. And the very first sentence after the greeting was, "Well, what would you like to have published?" With the Moya family, to know that after having studied with David Moyer, was my piano teacher at Oberlin, to get a call from the wife of his son, Bill Moyer, who had been one of the trombonists in the Boston Symphony, and to have his wife ask me, would I be interested in commissioning her work for her son? And these rather extraordinary connections that have seemingly come out of nowhere are deeply affecting in view of the paucity of things happening that I've tried to pursue to create opportunities, and then to find that things would happen without my being necessarily involved in making them happen. I can't say exactly what the future holds. Sometimes I think, well, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, people would contact me to say that they played this work of mine or that work of mine. I have fewer contacts, even with the advantages of email, than I did, say, 25 years ago. But at the same time, there are all these things that occasionally happen when, for example, just a few months ago, I am informed that the New Jersey Symphony wants to commission me to do work. I have been happy just to have them do Lilacs, which they haven't done, or another work, but to have them commission me to do work presents a challenge which I'm trying to meet right now. And I realize that the things happen under a certain kind of surface that one is not aware that sometimes are extremely fortuitous and at the same time unpredictable, and that as time passes, one can expect that there will be more of this happening. But when, it's almost impossible to say.
Well, it's an extraordinary achievement against the backdrop of the time period, an improbable and extraordinary achievement, where other composers had simply to worry about the work they would do and meeting their assignments and meeting their deadlines. You would find yourself wasting your energy and time with people trying to seat you in certain compartments on trains and trying to find where there would be housing, wherever you were studying at that time, and let alone the internal silence and opposition of the musical establishment. But I think, in the aggregate, weighed against the achievement and the prize, I think it's an extraordinary achievement, and you've had an extraordinary life.
That's very kind of you to say that. I'm so glad that you did read the book, and that you were able to discern what I've been saying, because there are persons out there who only think in terms of what they consider to be my complaints, and they don't grasp the fact that the opportunities that I might have had never materialized because of obstacles, because of obstructions and delays, and I have been fortunate to have lived long enough to have seen results that I could not possibly have anticipated.
Well, I think that I was telling a friend that for me, the most extraordinary aspect of the autobiography is there comes a moment when I think you've just finished your European piano tour, and you're looking for management to thinking, I assume you're going to have a career as a concert pianist. And I really felt that in this moment, if circumstances had been other than they were at that time, and you had had this career, and at this moment that your father's prophecy, everything seemed to turn in a moment. Your father said to you one day as you all were driving away from some event, he said, they will never give you what you deserve. But I think that one of the great ironies of your career has been if they had not, in a way, impeded your career as a pianist, I don't think you would have been the extraordinary composer we know today.
Well, I certainly wouldn't have been able to turn out as many works, and I would have had difficulty pursuing getting the opportunities to write work and feeling comfortable that I had time to finish the works. But I'm somewhat amazed at the years of 1975-1976 when I was chairman of the music department at Rutgers. I had taken a leave of absence. I was teaching at Peabody, and I had a chair at the University of Delaware that didn't require me to attend too frequently meetings with students, but to have found a time when I was not really well to write the piano concerto and the dialogues in that period and follow it with the mass. I don't know how I could have done that.
I think that's it in a nutshell. I think that these things are true. And as you say, you never know. We make plans, but we never know.
We never know.
I can't tell you how much I have enjoyed this conversation and how truly inspiring and uplifting I find the work. As I say, for the reasons really of its art, if all aspects of your biography were to completely disappear and you were to be like, I was thinking about this as I was making my way here this morning, and you were to be like a medieval composer and all that was left, or maybe five of six of your works, and we just had the music, the trombone concerto, the lilacs, the serenata, the violin concerto, and the first piano concerto, and maybe the string quartet number one. If there were nothing but those pieces, I think that you could feel secure in your legacy and that the work will stand on its own. I really do feel this.
Well, that's very kind of you to say that. And you mentioned the serenata, which, you know, the circumstances under which it was written, and I was asked to write it, to me, it was very affecting, and I tried to relate it to those particular circumstances. And then, of course, there are other works, too, which I take pride in the technical aspects of the works, like Five Fantasies, a series of variations on four or five notes, works that will never be heard with any degree of frequency, but still I hope that they will be heard, and it's true, as you say, that I do have these other works which somehow I feel do represent what I've tried to do in the particular time period in which I was writing.
Is there any topic or piece that you'd like to discuss that we have not touched on before we go?
Well, oddly enough, my Sinfonia number one, that was commissioned by the Frauen Foundation, had only one performance until it was recorded. It was commissioned back in the 80s. The work was performed at Tanglewood by the student orchestra called the Tanglewood Festival Orchestra. When I decided that I wanted to have it recorded, and I heard the recording, I was astonished because I realized that a few people had heard the work as I had heard it. And I remember a concertmaster conducted the performance at Tiger Wood, and his comment and was, well, it's so fragmented. And yet I said made some of the nicest comments about my music since that time. It's a work in two movements, and it was my intention to make the most of the percussion section in the second movement. And I don't know that many persons could really understand what I was able to do with this work. But I'm satisfied that with this performance that the things that I hope would be heard are heard.
Well, Professor Walker, I can't thank you enough for giving us some of your valuable time. We hope that you will continue to write. Are you working for Are you working on anything right now? Or are you?
Yes, this commission for the New Jersey Symphony is, I also hope to do another piano recording. I've had to put that aside because of the commission. It may seem odd, but I've spent much more time practicing the piano than I have composing.
Yeah, you were missing that.
I have this obsession with the piano as an instrument, with trying to achieve things that I haven't done, trying to achieve things that other pianists have done, and it's wonderful that I can go back and forth from composition to practicing the piano. I think I would be extremely unhappy if I had more time to compose and no time to do anything else.
Right, right. Well, we want to thank you. And
well, it's great, great pleasure. And thank you for those really wonderful, wonderful insights and the way that you have put the questions as really quite remarkable. As far as interviews in the past, this is a high point.
Oh, well, thank you. Coming from you, that means a lot to me. We will also, I will be certain that when we get all this together, I'll make you some kind of disc so you have some idea of how the edited form came out.
Yes, that would be wonderful.
All right, sir. You have a very good afternoon, and thank you so much.
Thank you so much for your interest and for this wonderful conversation.
All right, sir. Have a good afternoon.
You too.
Bye-bye.